Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Inderst, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Stefano Gualini and Riccardo Fasone, the authors of Fictional Games, a philosophy of world building and imaginary play from 2023. The publisher, by the way, is Bloomsbury. Before we jump right in, though, I would want to let you know that if you like our show or this episode in specific, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the audio platform of your choice, and share this episode with your friends, family, and who else is important to you. And now back to the show. Today, we shall hopefully get rock-solid answers to questions such as, what roles do imaginary games have in storytelling, or why do fiction authors outline the rules of a game that the audience will never play? This book is combining perspectives from philosophy, literature theory, and game studies, and therefore provides the first in-depth investigation into the significance of fictional games within fictional worlds. Stefano and Riccardo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourselves.
It depends on what you mean by a bit. I could just say a human individual, and that would be the shortest answer. If you care to know more, I live in Malta. I'm an academic in games, and my background is in architecture and philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my name is Riccardo Fasone. I am a scholar and a professor at the University of Torino. I teach stuff relating to games and digital media in general, and I'm also a game designer. I've been doing different projects, especially in analog rather than digital games for the most part.
Okay, great. But of course, we have to check for your Ludo Street credibility. So please tell us and our listeners, what's your favorite game and the one or even the ones you're playing right now? I mean, not right now because, you know, but right now.
Sure. If I can start, my favorite games are the ones designed by Riccardo. That's my straight answer. And as far as what I'm playing right now, I'm in my fourth run of The Last of Us 2, and I'm also a competitive player of Super Smash Ultimate.
Yeah, I don't have, I think, a favorite game other than the ones designed by Stefan, of course, because now I feel compelled to sort of say this. But right now I'm we work well together, so that's something. So what I'm playing right now, I'm playing a nice downhill biking sort of simulator called Lonely Mountain Downhill. And I'm also playing extensively and sort of very intensively a card game, which is a fairly famous card game called Battle Lines from Rainer Knizia.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll circle back to your book now. In your book, you draw from contemporary cinema and literature, from The Hunger Games to the science fiction of Ian M. Banks, and thereby introduce five key functions that different types of imaginary games have in world building. But before we deep dive right in these five complexes, please tell our listeners, how did you come to write fictional games in the first place?
Okay, again, this could be a long story or a short one. The short version of it is that part of my research also deals with science fiction studies. And both for research and for pleasure, I was reading one summer a quite famous, I would say, book by Ian Banks, published in 1988, if I'm not mistaken, called The Player of Games. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Rudolf.
Unfortunately not, but please enlighten me. This sounds exciting.
The most exciting part for maybe the people listening to this podcast is that it is the only book that I know in which the protagonist is a game scholar. Mm-hmm. Right? And part of the plot of this book revolves around a fictional game called Azad. Right? As a matter of fact, I was so intrigued and interested in this fictional game, and actually that kind of that spawned a wider interest in representation of games in fiction, and especially those games that exclusively exist as fictional ideas, as fictional constructs, that is, things invented by authors to for us to imagine playful activities within a fictional world. Many of these games, like in the case of Azad in the book that I just mentioned, are unplayable in the sense they are quite incompletely sketched out or have qualities that do not necessarily align with how we build stuff or play stuff. And so I was very interested and I started doing some research on this topic, which culminated in a 2021 paper called Fictional Games and Utopia, The Case of Azad, which came out on a science fiction and film television journal, which is a Liverpool University journal. I loved it, and while doing research for it, I figured out that there was not much written on fictional games from the academic perspective and like from a philosophical perspective, and what's their contribution to our understanding of literature and how do they function as literary devices. And so I called up Ricardo and said, like, hey, would you be interested in taking this to the next step? Instead of only doing a paper on one game, focused on one use of one game in particular, again, Utopia and Azad, we decided to expand it into something that of a more general interest, something that other scholars might use to get inspiration or start their work on fictional games on. So again, it started that way, and I was lucky enough to be contacted by Bloomsbury to write with them. They say, do you have something ready? And it happened that I did have this idea ready. So Ricardo was so kind to join into this crazy kind of journey, and here we are now.
Perfect. Everything
comes being so long, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Like
No.
It was a short version, by the way.
Yeah, but everything came together. You know, the publisher, you pre-planning, a partner in crime. Perfect. So, please tell us what are fictional games exactly, and why should your listeners pay attention to them?
I'm also taking this question also because I partly answered it already. Mm. So fictional games are, again, those kind of games or playful activities or playable objects that only exist within fiction. And, maybe Ricardo will tell something more about this later, but why should your listeners pay attention? The thing is that for game studies, this is a field where our skills and our interest could be used and could be fruitfully put to the test. But it's also a field that we never looked at before as game scholars. As a matter of fact, by doing research for the previous paper, I told you there's very little written on fictional games from the point of view of games that only exist within the fiction. Mm. There is quite a sizable literature on detective novels or sports within games or science fiction themes within games. But we didn't look into this particular app until this point. So I suppose that if you're a game scholar looking for a new interesting field with almost yet untapped potential, this is a pretty interesting one, especially for the scholars with a background in, say, theater, philosophy of fiction, or literary studies. This would be my answer.
Yeah. Well, let us deep dive then in your five key functions. You start off by arguing that fictional games can emphasize the dominant values and ideologies of the fictional society they belong to.
Yeah, this is something that as game scholars, but also generally as people playing games, we can observe in real life, like outside of fiction. Games often sort of encapsulate the dominant or sort of the values, so to speak, and beliefs of a certain society, of a certain community, of a certain civilization. And so, you know, there's plenty of papers and articles describing how SimCity is sort of a city builder that sort of encapsulates the way in which we think about building cities in the real world, and how, you know, it sort of also incorporates sort of a late capitalist kind of ideology into its mechanics. And so we kind of know that games are playable ideologies, so to speak. And even McLuhan, back in Understanding Media, used to sort of wrote that you can tell a lot about a civilization or a community by sort of observing the games that are played within that context. And we sort of asked the question, is this true for fictional games as well? And we found out that this is actually very true, and that one of the main sort of functions of fictional games within works of fiction is that of being a sort of a placeholder, or a shortcut rather, for explaining to readers or the viewers of a film what the community or civilization they are encountering that work of fiction is all about. So, say in a science fiction novel, games are very helpful to sketch out, or sort of to let readers understand how things work within that world. And so we have a couple, more than a couple, we have a few examples of that in our book. For example, the film Quintet by Robert Altman, which is a late 1970s film in which a sort of dying civilization is sort of obsessively and almost fetishistically attached to a game they are playing, which sort of encapsulates and represents what they stand for, their values and their beliefs. But we have really plenty of examples of how fictional games represent ideologies. For example, a game called Wicked Grace, which is a game within the game Dragon Age Inquisition, which sort of tells us something about what the civilization that inhabits the world of Dragon Age Inquisition believes, what their values are, and the kinds of things that are similar to our society and the kind of things that are different. So yeah, fictional games, just like regular games, are kind of playable ideologies in our view.
Yeah. And right after that, you continue by underlining that some imaginary games function in fictional worlds as critical utopian tools. And thereby you argue they inspire shifts in the thinking and political orientation of the fictional characters. Well, how is this to be understood exactly?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's some sort of continuity from what we were saying earlier about ideology, in the sense that if we agree on the fact that games, and fictional games in this case, can represent dominant values and ideologies, we can also maybe infer or sort of maintain that they can also inform the understanding of these ideologies for people who maybe are against them, or that want to overthrow them, or that sort of have this utopian impulse in creating something better, or a better world or society than the one they live in. And so games can trigger that kind of understanding of one's predicament, and in turn also trigger some sort of impulse into changing that predicament, sort of overthrowing the forces that are oppressive in that case. And so we have, again, a few examples of how that happens. And there are maybe two ways in which this can happen. For example, games can be the representation of that utopian state of affairs towards which someone would be sort of aiming at. But mm-hmm. also they can, by sort of encapsulating the ideology of a society, they can make it present or make it very visible for the player, and then triggering them to sort of modify and change things. One example that I really enjoy is the novel The Running Man by Richard Bachman, which was the mm-hmm. sort of the pen name of early pen name used by Stephen King.
Yeah.
In which a number of TV, it's a future society where a number of TV games are played, and these are very cruel, sort of sadistic games. And the most important of those is The Running Man, where a man is captured, so to speak, and put in a very dangerous situation. And if he can escape sort of his assailants, or his the hunters are called in novels, he then receives a prize in money, but it doesn't happen. So the contestant is usually killed. And in this novel, the protagonist sort of takes a step sort of aside from playing the game, and realizes that the game is sort of the representation of the cutthroat society he lives in. And so he decides to sort of step outside of the game and aim for the heart of that society. I'm not saying more, because there's a spoiler alert involved here, but that's a very interesting case of games triggering some sort of utopian impulse, or utopian sort of a utopian desire in their player.
Hmm. Well, we have come across some fictional titles by now, but maybe it's time to for some hashtag real talk. Please tell our listeners now, what is the most interesting fictional game you have encountered during the work for this book, and why?
I'm going to start with this one. This is Stefano again. And I'm a very simple man, in the sense that we've been working on this game. I was saying game, but I meant book. I mean, the difference. Okay. Anyway, I've been working on this book together with Riccardo for the past, let's say, almost 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so we've encountered hundreds of fictional games. Actually, in the book, we talk about 93 in particular, but we could have added at least 40 more without trouble. Wow. But the book was becoming too big already. It's already 80,000 words. So where was I going with this? I'm a simple person, so I'm still in love with this very first one that triggered my interest. I'm still thinking of The Game of Azad as one of the most fascinating representations of games that could not exist in our world. And the reason for that is that, similar to what Riccardo was saying, is an example of a fictional game which is absolutely central to the narrative, and that also lends itself to a utopian use. So it's really strange. So depending on how you play the game, you propose a certain political vision. And it becomes very, very clear how playing a game as a manifestation of power, or as a replica of power, also leads to political changes within the actual structure of power. So it was a very fascinating idea. Plus, it's a very incomplete game that leaves a lot to be filled in by the imagination of the reader. And because it's, okay, again, maybe it was a bit too long ago, but it's part of a novel called The Player of Games. So to me, this was how I first fell in love with the topic, and I stick to it.
Yeah. I'm going a slightly different route here. There's a game in the novel I was referring to, The Running Man, that is only really alluded to maybe in a paragraph, maybe, I don't know, it's like six lines, it's not more than that. And it's one of these sadistic, cruel TV games that exist in this future society, and it's called Treadmill to Bucks. Mm-hmm. And it's in the description, it says something like, this is a TV game where we take people with, for example, with heart conditions, or people in very bad health, we put them on a treadmill, and the ones that survive get the bucks, so they get the money. And this is an example of a series of things that are interesting about fictional games. One is that they're very incomplete, but they can be imagined. So we kind of are able to fill in the gaps and imagine how that would work, what it would look like even on this sort of dystopian TV channel. Two, that they are a way for authors to show their craft. The description of that fictional game is very Stephen King in the sense that it is sort of has this sort of delicious sadistic quality to it, where you almost you're kind of feel bad about the fact that that it is so well written. You kind of enjoy the description of these poor people, you know, with heart conditions running on treadmills.
Yeah,
and the other thing that's interesting about it is that it sometimes fictional games show something that is sort of rooted, deeply rooted into games in general. And I think cruelty, or sort of some shades of cruelty, or examples of cruelty, can be found also in real games. But there's a cruel aspect. There's almost always some sort of playfully oppressive aspects in playing games, so that you're always sort of on the verge of being the oppressed or being the oppressor or being the sadistic or being the masochistic sort of subject within games. And I think these little description that that is found in that book sort of is a very good indication of this inherent sort of natural quality of games and play.
Or at least in the way that we understand them, right? Like, they're definitely a reflection of what we consider games. So in our society, we value, say, competition, performance, like domination of one over the other, territorial control, and so on and so forth. And it's not strange to see that often reflected in fictional games. But there are also fictional games that take the opposite route, right, Ricardo? In a sense that...
Yeah, absolutely. I think... sort of the way in which we understand games as a society, or sort of say inhabitants of Western countries in late capitalism, sort of course informs both the ways sort of how fictional games are written or shown in movies, but also the way of course in which we understand them. And that's why in the book we sort of make an attempt at reaching out to sort of explicitly to scholars from different cultural backgrounds. And we actually have a line in the book saying, you know, we have dealt with games that we are familiar with in terms of language, in terms of sort of cultural references, but we expect people who live in different cultural contexts or have a different background to be able to find something interesting in fictional games that are more familiar to them, or that they are, for example, in books that are only in a language that we weren't able to access or understand. And so there's, of course, a wide variety of fictional games that is completely untapped from our point of view.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I just took another look inside your lovely book, because I really do love the book cover. And Stefano, you got to tell me if I'm correct. It says here you also worked on the cover of the book. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, like Ricardo, and like also being an architect, as I mentioned, like I often do the art for my games or my books. Mm-hmm. So I was complicit in the design of the cover of the book. As you can tell, there's like an allusion to chess, which is often something we return to during the book, especially in the introductory chapters. But all the little pawns that play on these chessboards are referenced to different kinds of fictional games that are present in the book. If you open different chapters, you will see that different chapters are represented by different pawns that you also see on the front cover. So I don't know what else you want me to tell you, or how we made it, or...
No, I just wasn't aware till now, so it's really great. I loved it before, but now I just...
have this,
yeah.
You kind of have this do-it-yourself mentality about books and articles and games that we do. We tend to do most of the things that we can do by ourselves.
Hmm. Circling back again, your third point now, it aims to the circumstance that a few fictional games are conducive to the transcendence of a particular form of being, such as the overcoming of human corporeality. So would you please explain this argument for our listeners?
This is Stefano again. More than an argument is an observation that fictional games are also used in that transcendent way. Allow me to explain it very simply. It's going to be quite short. Mm-hmm. Ricardo mentioned that fictional games, very much like real games, as in the games we play in our actual societies, can, in a way, manifest ideological views or can suggest the overcoming of these ideological views in a form of subversion or rebellion or revolution or rejection of these values. Mm-hmm. Very good. What if we were to look at games that reject, instead of values, the, let's say, physical or cultural context you're part of? Think about, maybe, Rudolf, you've been German, you're familiar with the glass beads game by Hermann Hesse, right?
Yes.
I suppose you read it in school, I'm not quite sure. In any case, you know that in that book, you see that the game that they play, which is called, again, the glass beads game for the people who haven't read it, which is sort of like a game that encompasses culture. Is a game that in a way transcends culture and brings it into one single context of play and recombination and almost musical harmony, right? Mm-hmm. So in that case, you can take the game as an indication of how culture could be superseded by a superculture based on a game.
Right.
That would be a way in which, in a way, we can transcend human disciplines through a game or through a higher standpoint, culturally speaking. Instead, like a more down-to-earth answer to your question could be, for example, I'm thinking, I don't know if you're familiar with the science fiction author Alistair Reynolds. I mean, I'm bringing this out. I don't know if how many people here, I mean, listening, are also science fiction fans, but he's a brilliant author in my mind. And in a short story of his called Diamond Dogs, mm-hmm. There is a fictional game that requires the player to alter their body in order to progress, to the point that towards the game, they seem to be abandoning both the cognitive capabilities of humans and the bodily capabilities of human to cope with the game, to a point that at a certain point, they can no longer communicate or be recognized by humans, by anybody else. And they are uniquely driven by this obsession for the game. So there are fictional games that in a way show this kind of evolutionary push. There's something imposed on us, or maybe imposed by ourselves on us, that serve as a transformational stimulus or an evolutionary prod for us to go beyond our current, say, cultural or physical contexts. So there's quite a few games. This is perhaps the hardest of the six topics that we treat and maybe the most rare ones, but we found enough cases to, again, propose this observation to our readers.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, because to be honest, I didn't quite get it before your lovely explanation right now. That's great.
You know, I try. I dribble and shoot and hope for the best. I'm not always accomplishing my
That's
goals.
Great. Also, I find your fourth point now very fascinating, and help me here out if I understand you correctly. Imaginary games within works of fiction can deceptively blur the boundaries between the contingency of play and the irrevocably seriousness of, quote, real life. And they sort of do this by either camouflaging life as a game or disguising a game as something with more permanent consequences.
Yeah, so there's this literary trope we're probably all familiar with, where we read a book or encounter some sort of narrative, and we are sort of, the text asks us the question, or we ask ourselves the question, is this, what the characters within this narrative are living, is this a dream or is this reality? Are they dead or are they alive? Is this a game or is this not a game?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this form of subtle deception that is performed on the reader or the viewer, that it is also sort of one of the pleasures of some sort of certain narratives, you know, to figure out whether is this happening or is this a dream? Is this reality or not? And it's a very common trope, so to speak. And I think games are particularly adaptable in this sense. And the idea of a game being blurred within the confines or the limits of real life is something that works really well in fiction for a number of reasons. One reason is that we tend to understand games as separated from our actual lives. And so we tend to impose different rules on games than we would in real life. For example, if we're playing a game, a match, a tennis match or a tennis game with someone who is our boss at work, we're probably treating that person differently than we would at work. So we impose a different set of social rules even when we're playing a game with someone. And this, of course, can be taken to extremes in different forms of narrative. There's a film we quote in the book called The Game by David Fincher. It's a fairly popular, very nice, very cool film with Michael Douglas, where this man spends the whole movie thinking, sort of trying to figure out whether what he's going through is a game or not. And of course, this has major consequences because his understanding is, if this is a game, then I have nothing to be worried about, nothing to fear, because there's no harm that can come out of a game, right? But if this is not a game, then I'm in big trouble, because this is real life, and so all the things I'm going through may actually be harmful or even kill me in the end. And another example that we make is a fictional game in an episode of the TV series Rick and Morty, which I'm sure most people are familiar with at this point. And this fictional game is called Roy, A Life Well Lived. And it's a sort of, it's portrayed as an arcade kind of game where you go in an arcade room and play that game. And it's a sort of a virtual reality experience where you live as a sort of a regular kind of normal, or what is supposed to be a normal human going through different phases of their life. And so this is sort of an interesting opposite of what we think of as a game. So in a very sort of adventurous, complicated, frantic world such as that of Rick and Morty, then the game is to play a very sort of normal, kind of almost boring life. And so, but this is an immersive experience where the player of the game sort of forgets about the fact that that is a game. And so this is a very interesting trope, because games are both separate but also inevitably blurred into our lives. And so sort of entering and exiting games is one thing we do very often and sort of in a very almost a natural fashion, but that can be used as sort of fuel for narrative in very interesting ways.
Yeah, right. Ricardo, also think about Ricardo mentioned Rick and Morty as an example of, say, pop culture reference. Another one that the listeners might be familiar with is the one episode of Black Mirror called Playtest, in which, again, the whole episode is played on this kind of blurred and permeable boundary between, am I living real life, or is this still part of the game that I decided to play, or is this a weird combination of both? I think Ricardo did a fantastic job, so I just wanted to add this little piece of info in case people were not familiar with Rick and Morty, but perhaps with Black Mirror.
Yeah, totally. So it's a huge portfolio, obviously. So I can only recommend take a look inside this book for yourself out there, people. And last but not least, fictional games can function as meta-reflexive tools, suggesting critical and or satirical perspectives on how actual games are designed, played, sold, manipulated, experienced, understood, and utilized as part of our culture.
This is Stefano again. I think this is one of my most liked and absolutely favorite pieces of the book, because I'm very interested in this idea of meta-referentiality and self-reflection. So if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, think, for example, of a novel within a novel, right? What kind of expressive role would that have? Well, it can in a way match or parallel some of the events in the actual novel, right? In the action novel, or it can be used as a, I don't know, a criticism of how novels are written or sold or on the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. So it has like kind of a tongue in cheek and sort of kind of a bit of meta and kind of snarky, normally little comments on the culture that generated something. And we see that also in fictional games within fiction, and in particular about fictional games within games, right? Yeah. Think about, for example, I think the paramount example here would be in Disco Elysium. I don't know if you play it, Rudolf, but I suppose that being such a big hit, many of the listeners in game studies would have probably played it. You know that there's plenty of fictional games in Disco Elysium, and most of them are board games, such as the Rau Britta or the Viticulturist or Archipelago of Insulinde. Or again, like you can find fictional games all over the game, and they are used very expressively. One fictional game in particular is a sort of a video game played via the radio, right? It's called Viral Untethered. And the player gets to know about this game by visiting the game developer's studio that was abandoned and it's in some basement in Martinez. The player also gets to know about this game by talking to the former developers who abandoned the game because it was becoming too expensive and too large and was taking a toll on their mental health.
Yeah.
And I believe it doesn't take like a lot of imagination to recognize a definite meta referential intent here in the developers of Disco Elysium, Zaum, to present the story of a small development team biting off more than they could chew in working to produce like a large, narratively intricate and large-scale title. So in a way, they use a game within a game to talk about their own adventure, their own struggle, or their own design issues with their own games. And there's many more like this. Take, for example, and this is going to be very quick, in The Simpsons, I don't know, there's plenty of fictional games, right? And mm-hmm. they generally are sarcastic winks and smirks to the games industry, as in, look how stupid kind of games you do, how derivative this everything is, and how poorly marketed and how brutal this stuff is in terms of, say, subtlety, violence, marketing. Again, like this kind of self-reflexivity also lends itself as a satire towards game culture, game design, the games industry, the market models we follow, and so on and so forth. I find this particularly great because, again, it gives us a lens to reflect on game studies and game culture by looking at a game within a game. And that's kind of freaky and interesting and cool, and I like that very much.
Since we're entering the final round now, so this is where I'd like to ask my guests for a little meta reflection. Suits perfectly, of course, to your answer. What aspects and ideas would you have loved to include in your book and that didn't make the cut? And secondly, and I'm really excited to ask that one, where do you see game studies as a research field in general at the moment?
This is Stefano again. It's a very difficult question to answer. And it's so good, in fact, that I don't want to spoil it with a bad answer, at least the one concerning game studies. Where is it going in the future? I have no idea. You definitely know that this is not a single field, but a fragmented set of disciplinary approaches, and sometimes multidisciplinary, sometimes monodisciplinary. But again, it's very hard to boil it down into or to consider it under a single header. So game studies is more like a capture-all kind of categorical word. And so it's very hard to say, like, where is this going as a field in the future? I mean, if you're thinking about AI in games or, I don't know, emotion in games and narrative and game design and game development and industry studies and so on, they're all going into their own separate little ways. Mm. I can only answer from the point of view of fictional games, and I think this is a particularly interesting topic to further develop, especially for games scholars that, as I mentioned, have a background in either philosophy, theater, literary studies, or media studies. So it's sort of like maybe a bit of a side kind of topic, but one that can be approached, I believe, fruitfully by game scholars that are interested in narrative expression, the artistic or philosophical value of games. So I hope this little effort of ours is pioneering a new field that will become part of the future of game studies. I don't know how important or how frequented, but this is my hope. For the rest of the discipline, I don't think I can say anything interesting or meaningful.
Yeah, I think one thing that's happening generally within game studies and within a lot of similar sort of disciplines that were born as small niche communities gathered around an object that was not particularly present in academia before, you know, maybe 25 or 30 years ago. Is that the interest, the focus of game studying is diversifying in a way. And so we are including, for example, analog games as part of our research focus, which is something that would not have been maybe possible or as common a few years ago. So we're sort of starting to look into playful objects that are not necessarily digital. And of course, as an even more general take, I would say there's a diversification in the kinds of themes, both in terms of politics and representation that we are addressing in a kind of voices that are being heard within the communities of game studies. And I think this is very healthy and good for the field, for the community, and for the scientific output that we are able to produce as game scholars. As far as stuff that didn't make the cut of the book, I think both Stefano and I are kind of toying with the idea that one thing that we did not discuss enough, but would like to maybe discuss a little further, and this is one of Stefano's sort of main points of interest, and one of Stefano's darlings, so I'll maybe leave the word to him about it, is how fictional games are used for comedy or for sort of comedic effects, how these games work as comedic tools within the tool set of someone, you know, writing a novel or sort of any form of narrative, and how fictional games in their incompleteness, that their incompleteness is also, can also be fun, can also be interesting in terms of their comedic effects. Stefan, do you have anything to say about this?
You've been very eloquent, and in the book we treat comedy briefly in one of the initial chapters, but it didn't become one of the key topics of focus of the book, as Rudolf also noticed. So if we were to take it, me and Ricardo, somewhere else, I think the game could have done with another chapter on comedy, but this might be something for our next work, or maybe something that the listeners and the game scholars interested in this idea could take further. So I think comedy would be one. Again, self-reflexivity is very interesting, and there's a lot of work to do. Cultural specificity is another thing that Ricardo mentioned during one of his answers. So those are the like low-hanging fruits that I can think about right now.
Yeah. Well, Stefano and Ricardo, we've taken a lot of your time. So more in an Apple keynote way of generating attention, one more thing. What are you working on right now? And of course, what will you be playing next?
This is Stefano. So I'm currently finishing a science fiction novel with a philosophical background that's going to come out, I suppose, next year with Routledge. And also like working with, again, Daniel and Ricardo on other things. But what will I be playing next? I think I'm traveling to Japan starting from next week. And I downloaded a Steam game called Monster Train, which I'm hoping to master in the month and a half I'm going to be away.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm working on a book that has nothing to do with games, but I was trained as a film scholar, film and media scholar, so I'm working on a book about Italian crime films of the 1970s. So sort of, cops and robbers types of films from the 1970s. They have this very also sort of cool aesthetic of, you know, late 70s or mid 70s rather, sort of crime and violence film that was very present in sort of Italian cinema. So I'm working on a book about that. And I have bought the Metroid Prime remaster, and it's a game I want to revisit. I've played it back when it came out, but I would like to revisit it. So I think I'm going to make some time to play that in the future.
Well, these sound like awesome projects. I have to say, I'm very excited. And I want to thank you now for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation. Take care. Goodbye and have a good week.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us. Bye-bye.
Likewise. Bye.
So, dear listeners, I hope you liked this episode. If you are an author and or an editor in the field of game studies yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, please do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.inderst@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Inderst almost everywhere. See you in a bit.